From the Index of Incunabulia to Laser Typography, a personal journey through the history of the printed word. Coming up. Hello. This is Stephen DeLuque, and you are listening to a segment of Issues and Ideas called Ears on Art, where we discuss the importance and influences of the visual arts. Ears on Art is produced at the studios of listener-supported KCBX Public Radio, serving the California Central Coast from Salinas to Ventura. Our guest for the next 2 weeks is Brian Lawler, professor in the Graphics Communications Department at Cal Poly, and a passionate proponent of the art and science of typography. Brian has an upcoming show of his panoramic photographs at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art, but more on that later. Co-host Krista Hewitt and I visited with Brian at his home in San Luis Obispo.
Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Krista. Thank you, Stephen.
Welcome, Brian.
Photography started early in your life. When did the interest in graphic communications and printing and...
Much earlier. My mother was a newspaper editor, and I grew up in Oakland. In the basement of our home was a letterpress, a little 8x12 Chandler and Price letterpress. And it had been purchased by her dad, who I never met, in the late 1940s, and there were, I don't know, maybe a dozen California job cases full of type. And my father, who was an insurance broker, had a project every year at Christmas time where he would have the Lawler family kids, our free labor force, sit around the table, and we would stick gold labels that said Lawler Insurance Services across the top with his address and his telephone number, which was Lockhaven 21813. And the little stickers we printed ourselves on this letterpress. So each year at October, my mother would go downstairs and pull the cover off the letterpress, and she would show us how to change the date on the sticker or whatever by setting the type. And I learned a little bit about that. And when I was 11 years old, I decided to start a printing company. It wasn't completely honest, but I called it the Teenage Print Shop. Went into the business of printing little letterpress cards, business cards, envelopes, letterheads, and that sort of stuff. Actually made money as a 12, 13-year-old kid. And when I went into high school, my dad, I can't remember exactly how it happened, but he ran into a guy who had defaulted on the lease of a small offset printing press. And he asked the man who was going to repossess it if he paid off the lease, could we have it? And he said, sure. And it was a deal. Then we had the whole show. I think it was capable of printing 11 by 17 paper, single color, little machine called a Multilith 1250. And I had taken a class at high school to learn how to make plates and make little paste-ups and negatives and expose the plates. I didn't have a plate maker. I walked into a shop in Berkeley, directly across the street from the Claremont Hotel, into a little company called Design Enterprises. But I walked in the door and I asked the proprietor if he could help me out by making plates. And his name is Ellis Myers, and he's still alive, and we still communicate. He reads my blogs every day. He critiques my blogs every day. He corrects spelling errors in my blogs to this day. He's a wonderful man. And he said, well, certainly we could do that for you. And not only that, I'll show you how to do it. And after several months, he had given me a key, and I could go into his shop at night after school, and I could make negatives and plates, and I just agreed to repay him for the supplies that I used. You know, most teenage kids have moments when they flounder. I floundered. I was 14 years old. I was listless. I didn't care. And my mom and dad read something about the new School for Country Printers at Cal Poly, and they pushed me into the car and said, we're going to go see Cal Poly. And we came down into what was then the new Graphic Arts Building, Building 26. In April of 1964, I can show you the exact place where I was standing in that building. And I said to my mom and dad, I'm going to go to this school. And I set my mind to it, and I did. And with a little delay for joining the Coast Guard and transitioned into the Coast Guard Reserve, which I did for 6 years. But I did that concurrently with starting my career at Cal Poly. So I would drive from here to Yerba Buena Island every month for 6 years, and then 2 weeks each summer, and then ended up on a helicopter crew as a photographer, which was kind of the pinnacle of my Coast Guard career. It was really fun. It provided me with a lot of discipline. I'm an Eagle Scout. I was always involved in things involving leadership and leadership training. I took to the Coast Guard like a duck to water, and it wasn't quite as romantic then, I mean, as I make it sound now. I was seasick for an awful lot of the time. It was kind of embarrassing. But, you know, the reality is that I saved a man one time, myself. I pulled a guy out of the San Francisco Bay, and that really changes you. It's pretty amazing. I moved to Cal Poly in January of 1969, GRC, or it was then called Printing, Engineering, and Management. I thought it was just the cat's pajamas. I mean, this is the finest thing I'd ever seen. We had 18 linotype machines, and we had a couple of L-rod machines, if anybody has any idea what those are. They're machines that cast strips of lead. Couple of Ludlow headline setters, and we had a clunky old newspaper press that I became the manager of within a few months of being at Cal Poly. I mean, I dived in and was just enthralled with all this stuff. And yet the first year, the end of the first year, I remember sort of thinking, I kind of missed the Industrial Revolution. It's already all been invented. There's nothing left to invent. I'm just learning how to use a bunch of old equipment that it's never going to change. In the fall of 69, they rolled this box into the building and took the box apart, and inside of it was a computerized typesetting machine. And this changed everything. It made possible typography in ways that you can't do with metal and wood, and it just sparked this interest in me that I have to this day. So I was able to parlay an interest in typography, which is what I really had as a 12-year-old, handset type, and I used to visit Type Foundry in San Francisco, walk up Folsom Street to where the Mackenzie and Harris Type Foundry was, and the woman at the counter, Helen Lee, she would greet me, and I'd go in and I'd buy, you know, a little bit of type in this style, a little bit in that. I'd spend 75 cents on type. And then Colonel Harris, who I think his name was Colonel, I don't know. He was the Harris of Mackenzie and Harris. He would take me in and show me cool things that he was a collector of historic stuff. So I had the bug. I thought I wanted to be a printer. The problem was back then is they didn't really define typographer versus printer. What I really was a typographer. So that was my chosen profession.
And just for definition, my father was a printer, so I think I probably have this one. But let's just clarify typographer versus printer.
Yeah, typographer is a person who works with type to make words on paper. And a printer takes those words on paper and reproduces a number of them. Yeah, there's a distinction. Back in the days when I had tintype, I mean, I defined 13 separate occupations of people who worked for me. I had a person whose job it was to retouch little spots on negatives. That was his occupation. I had a man who made photographs of photographs, full time. I had another man who took photographs of line art, not photos. And they worked together to make film that would then be used to make plays. It's bizarre to think about now, but somehow delightfully arcane, you know. But anyway, I was at Cal Poly. I'm cruising along. All of a sudden, I just fell in love with this new era of technology, which was the application of computers to typography. And that changed five complete generations in the 40 years or so that I've lived here. You know, it's really quite amazing. We went from casting molten lead into type to strike-on composition, which was typewriters, basic fancy typewriters, to photocomposition systems that used film negatives and strobe flashes to strobe characters off these little pieces of film on complicated machines. I owned all of them. And then they moved from there to cathode ray tube machines, which would paint letters onto the face of a optically flat television picture tube, which was then in contact with a piece of photofilm that would make images. And then that gave way to the final generation, which was laser beams. When you go through all five generations of that technology and you end up with the laser beam, what ends up happening is that at every stage of the process, the letters remain the heart of the art of typography. The technology is fluid underneath. It doesn't matter what technology you use. But the good news is that it has gotten better and better and better. So things which would have been impossible in the 1970s to do, like that lettering right there, which is roughly 3 inches tall and razor sharp, in the 1970s would have been impossible because it would have been difficult or impossible to hold the sharpness at that size. So what laser beam typography gives us today, painting things with laser beams at phenomenal rates of speed, lasers don't know if it's big or small. They don't care. You draw a big letter, you draw a small letter. And the other part of it, of course, is that Adobe, which is the key purveyor of the technology at the core of type fonts today, they put into our hands the finest typographical systems in the history of the world. So today, a person who is skillful with Adobe Illustrator, knows about type, has at their disposal the finest, most accurate, sharpest, crispest, cleanest environment for typography in the history of the world. And anybody can do it. You can sign up now for the monthly thing called Creative Cloud from Adobe, and you get all their programs, and you have access to the same software that the world's most talented designers have. And the trick is understanding how to use type.
That was going to be my question.
That is the secret.
Because to be able to, you know, get it printed, mm-hmm. perhaps in that sense anybody can do. But is there still a fundamental visual component that we're going to play on here in terms of how to learn the intricacies of setting type, whatever your mechanism is? In other words, in terms of spacing and everything else, how do you convey that to students?
Well, we teach several courses in typography. One of them is required. We have a basic digital typography course in Cal Poly's graphic communication program. They also teach typography in the art and design department. We're very serious about this. Every student must take typography. I also teach an advanced typography class, and it's only for those who are type geeks. And I get roughly 20 a year who want to learn how to draw type. That font right there, the slow panel, is my design.
The creator here is Brian Lawler, our guest today on Ears on Art, here on KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. Brian is a professor in the Graphic Communications Department at Cal Poly, and he continues now with some more insight on what it takes to develop a font.
So not only did I set that type, I drew that type. It's something I've been working on for more than 5 years, and it's a passion that I have that is really extreme, and I don't recommend it to most people because it's too complicated. But I start off next quarter, teaching advanced typography with a kind of a blanket statement that from the time you strike a key on your keyboard to the time the image of that letter shows up on your screen is a master's degree. There is so much technology between one end of that event and the other end of the event that we all take for granted that I don't worry about it, I don't obsess about it, but I am dazzled by it because I know how letters are designed, but I don't know all of the technologies in the middle. I appreciate them. Mm-hmm. And when a letter shows up on my screen with the kind of precision that we can see today on our computer displays, it is refreshing. It's very, very satisfying. So what I try to teach the students in terms of the art of typography is the selection of a type font that is both pleasing and effective and legible and readable, different terms. Mm-hmm. They're all very difficult things to teach. Yes, anybody can do it, but no, not everybody does it well. And so when I teach that, I try to get them to learn about things that work versus things that don't work, and that's nearly impossible to teach, but what I want to do is inspire them to learn over their entire lifetimes. So when I have them look at type, I want them to be critical. I want them to say, why does that work and this not work? Or why is this website an effective website when this other website is not? It has to do with spacing and the inter-character spacing. That font, for example, which I call Pan, P-A-N, it has 320 characters, total. In the world of typography today, characters are not called characters anymore. It's not sophisticated enough. So we call them glyphs. And so it has 320 glyphs, which include a lot of repetitions, but there are the 26 lowercase letters and the 26 capital letters and the 10 numerals and about 100 diacritical marks, which are, you know, all the accents and punctuations and symbols and all that sort of stuff. And then there's a whole small caps alphabet of that entire alphabet. And then there's a whole small caps set of numerals that goes with the small caps alphabet. And when you're done, you've just started. I have a pretty good friend, a guy who makes his entire living designing type fonts. And he said to me one day when we were talking about type fonts, he says, nobody ever finishes a type font. What you do is you declare victory. And you move on. You know, it's all you can do. Because I remember we were having coffee one time up in Silicon Valley someplace, and he was teaching me something about spacing, character spacing. And I thought I knew. I had no idea. And when you build all the characters and you put them into their required spaces, that's one thing. And then you test it and you test it and you test it and you discover that there are exceptions. Okay, there's one right here. This is an exception where the letter, my word, my first name, Brian, with cap B, lowercase r, I. If you set that, this, by the way, is a font called Helvetica Neue, which is it's the light version. I think it's 45 or 35. It's one of the lighter ones. It's a plain vanilla font, but it's also a very elegant font. But if you set lowercase r, lowercase I together, they will bump into each other. And it doesn't read as Brian. It almost reads like banan or something with a dot over it, right, which doesn't make any sense. So then what you do as a type designer is you go in and you create what are called kerning tables. And the kerning tables say, always do this except for these 4,000 times when there are exceptions. And the 4,000 is not an exaggeration. There are 4,000 exceptions in that font. I've never finished the font. I've never declared victory. I'm not quite there yet. What do they call it? Postpartum anxiety. I can't separate myself from that. I can't let my baby go out into the world. And part of the reason that I can't let my font loose because I'm not satisfied that I've found all the exceptions yet. Because this is several man years of time in one font. Teaching students how to use type involves understanding classifications. When I buy a new book about typography, I read the first couple of chapters. I think, well, this is really neat stuff because it talks about what's good about typography. And then usually at about the 50% point in the book, they completely collapse because they run out of stuff to say. How do you impart the soul of typography to a reader? A lot of people do it by giving rules. Well, you cannot use more than 3 type fonts on any project. Well, my reaction is that's hogwash. I've got one. I've got, 14 fonts in it. If they work together, go for it. But, oh, no, you can only use 3. Well, who said that? Well, Mrs. Potter said that to us in 1964 when, my reaction to that is give it up. There was a guy named Sherbo who wrote these manuals for really good typography in the 1950s. He was an advertising type designer out of Chicago in the heyday of advertising typography. And he said things like, never use a script font because it causes blindness. You know, you wonder, what is he talking about? Or, don't use script with a sans serif font because it will hurt the reader's eyes. I mean, you're talking about physiological damage being done. I mean, that's nonsense. We know this today. But then, I have colleagues who say, you should never, ever use Times Roman. Why not? It's a beautiful font. It's just overused. I mean, Comic Sans. Comic Sans. I laugh at Comic Sans. There's a professional version of Comic Sans now with over 3,000 characters, which makes me laugh even harder. Comic Sans is a ridiculous type font. It serves a purpose. It's just not one I happen to like. There are some sort of, I'll call them rules, maybe roulettes, that you really should be careful to observe. And that, I would say, in general, is don't mix 2 different serif fonts. Serif fonts are those that have a little bump sticking out. Well, generally speaking, you put 2 different kinds of serif fonts together and they're going to clash. there's just something awkward about it. It's, you know, some people would say we like wearing vertical stripes and horizontal stripes together. You know, there are people who are very, very conscientious about how they dress. You're obviously one of them. Looking at Stephen, by the way. Chris and I over here are sort of the T-shirt set. The reality is that there are people who are as sharp about dress and of what you should and shouldn't wear, who could would have no better luck trying to explain it to somebody. It's all about subtlety. It's all about detail. It's all about choosing the right medium for the message, the medium being the type font. Isadora Duncan, is that her name?
Yeah.
She said that when type does its job best, and I'm misquoting her here, but I'm paraphrasing, you don't see it at all.
I think that's often the case with a lot of things. If I'm designing an exhibit, the work better show off, not the exhibit.
Yeah, or if I'm looking at the pixels in one of these panoramic photos, I mean, oh, there's a spot of dust on that photograph. I'm missing the bigger message. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is true of typography to a great degree. Yeah.
Presuming that the other very basic here has to do with positive negative space, that ability to really understand what isn't there because it's making up what is.
The trick with a lot of this electronic stuff is it's so easy to overdo it. Mm-hmm. You know, people, you know, draw a rectangle. That's one. That's fine. Put a photograph in it. Fine. Put a border around it. Fine. Put a drop shadow on it. One too many. You know, put a...
Change the background color.
Yeah, exactly. Put another drop shadow on the drop shadow. And in Photoshop, you can put inverse shadows inside of bevels. And you can do all this wacky stuff that in the hands of very talented people can be effective. But most of the time, I tend to say, you know, back off, stop at two. I really don't believe in the rules of typography. But I, you know, I kind of throw them out as guidelines, you know. And beyond that, then it's really a matter of learning about the history and the application of typography. I love typographic history. Cal Poly has a fabulous replica of the Gutenberg Bible. And in my advanced typography class, one of the very early things we do in that class, we all run over to the library, to special collections, and we all put on our cotton gloves, and we open up the Gutenberg Bible replica, which is a book that was printed in the 15th century, by a man who had no predecessors. He actually did in China and Korea, but none that he knew of. And he developed not just a beautiful type font and printed a beautiful book, but he had to develop all the technology to make it possible. And not only did he do that, but he did a gorgeous job of printing them. They are as good, when you look at them, as anybody's finest works in their entire careers, and he did it on the first try. This was an extraordinary man. And I have the students just breathe this in because it's in Latin. Most of us can't read it, but it is stunningly beautiful. It's lovely stuff. And what's stunning about it, I liked, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, it's not what's on the page, it's what's not on the page. It's the gigantic white borders around the type. The type's packed in like so many typographic sardines, but the page is not cramped. The page is not forced. Everything about a Gutenberg Bible is, if anything, understated for the 15th century. It's quite an amazing piece of work. But the interesting thing is that in order to earn the favor of the Catholic Church, he had to produce a book that was the correct version of the Bible, and it was a standard Bible of its time. He then had to make it pretty for the sake of his patrons, who were very wealthy people. It would have been kings, princes, and very, very, very high up religious leaders in the Catholic Church. The curious thing about what Gutenberg did, and you know, some people, you know, say, well, you know, he printed the Bible, that was an instant bestseller because it was already a popular book. Okay, you know, you could call it a commercial success. He knew what to print. And these were people who he knew could afford it. Smart man. He did okay. What he did, though, for society, which is in the sense of typography important and in the sense of the bigger picture, which is to say communication, Gutenberg created the environment in which anybody of any discipline in any language could reproduce what they wanted to say. Poets, authors, scientists, anybody could say anything using his technology. I mean, almost single-handedly, he empowered people with something to say with a method of doing it. I argue Gutenberg created the Renaissance. And the proof of this is the British Museum has an index, which they call the Index of Incunabula, which is a fancy word somebody made up to describe early books that are printed with movable type. And the roots of the word comes from swaddling clothes, so it means infancy in its Latin roots. In the time between 1451 and 1501, which was the era that was marked at the beginning of the production of the Gutenberg Bible to the beginning of the next century, but there were 49,000 titles were printed in that 50-year period. In the 50 years that followed that, there were tens of millions. And the British Library limits their incunabula index to the 50 years from Gutenberg to the first year of the 16th century. The explosion of printed publications after that does vindicate the technology because nobody could stop it. The niftiest part of this is that it spread like a fire through Western Europe and then into North America and so on. I love this part. Gutenberg and Da Vinci were alive at the same time. Gutenberg's ideas very definitely came around to Italy. And in Venice, which is where all the great type design was done, that was a result of Gutenberg's work sort of traveling over to France and bouncing off of France and coming back across Italy into Venice. Venice at the time was a city-state.
And the world comes round and round.
It does.
And
it
round.
Does. And you know, it just keeps going. When you look at the excitement people had for saying whatever they had to say, it's unbelievable. Martin Luther, if he had made one copy of his 95 protestations and nailed them on the church, and they would have tied him to the stake and lit it on fire the next morning, and we would never have known the names Martin and Luther put together. But Martin Luther was a smart guy. He got 200 copies made. Mm-hmm. And we have, as a result of that, the entire Reformation.
Here are you, Brian Lawler, able to keep students understanding what this rich history is about.
It's fun. And it's great. And it has modern analogs, which is also really fun.
Brian, I know that you've been through quite a bit in this last week, but you've been very stoic here.
My mother used to say, whenever you go out, wear clean underwear, so that if you ever get hit by a truck, you won't be embarrassed. And the other day when I had been hit by a truck, literally, the firefighters were moving me onto the backboard and they had isolated my neck and they grabbed me by the belt and they started to pick me up and my undies showed. And I said, I'm wearing clean undies. I at least got a chuckle out of these very fine young men who were helping me when I was injured on the street the other day.
Thank you so much. And Stephen?
A rapid convalescence for you, and we're looking forward to the show.
I appreciate it. You'll see me there. I'm the guy in the wheelchair. thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
We will continue our conversation with Brian Lawler next week, where we focus, no pun intended, on his career as a photographer. Brian's show of panoramic photographs, Slow Pano, opens at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art on Friday, February 14th. This is Stephen DeLuque.
And this is Krissa Hewitt. You have been listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX Public Radio. Thank you so much for listening.